the record for the longest distance to come to Sunday Conversations, come 300 miles from Sunderland. Please, can you welcome Craig Hilton. Thanks, Craig. Thank you for coming. I think it may be one of those things which 6 months ago it seemed a really good invitation, a bit nearer the time you're thinking, what have I let myself in for? But you're here and we're very grateful. Now, if someone had bumped into you, say, a dozen years ago, they would have thought you had it made. Wife, kids, good job, nice home, nice car, villa in Spain, lucky old you. But if they bumped into you again a year or so later, what would they have seen?
They would have seen a man very broken, a man very lost, really. There's a well-known saying, you're only a couple of paychecks away from the street. Well, I believe you're only a couple of circumstances away from the street. Because I went from what I thought was having everything that I was supposed to have to being destitute, to being homeless on the street, very isolated. Scary place.
And where was this?
This was in Newcastle. I had managed to get a job in Newcastle, and it was looking after all the food franchises in all of the northeast train stations. But that lasted a day, and I had a full mental breakdown, along with alcohol-induced psychosis, and relapsed to the point of being arrested.
And you were begging on the streets in Newcastle, sleeping in a skip sometimes, is it?
Yeah, sleeping behind the next door, so at least it was a decent shop. It wasn't a cash converter or anything like that. But, under a fire exit, it was... It's such a scary thing, John. It's so scary. It's so lonely. So, I mean, I'd been assaulted, I'd been peed on, excuse me. I'd been spat on, I'd been robbed. And this is really from about 6 weeks of having all of that that you mentioned to this. You can't fathom out how quickly what's happened. Why me?
Had anything prepared you for just living a rough life like that?
No, I had had an extremely privileged background, and nothing can prepare you for that isolation. That I wasn't streetwise. I was a soft southerner. I was middle class background, and I'd been very privileged.
Let's hear about that. Let's go back to the beginning. You're born 57 years ago. Tell us about the family you were born into.
My father was a headmaster. And that's a funny picture.
Oh, yes. you can recognise Craig instantly, I think, from being the little one on the end. Yeah, carry on, yes.
My dad, I was born in Blackburn in Lancashire, but when I was only 6 months old, we moved to Buxton in Derbyshire, where my dad took up a job as a teacher there. We then moved to Caister-on-Sea when I was six, where he took up a headmastership. My mum worked in a playgroup and a librarian. My dad then became chairman of the magistrates and chairman of the parish council. Mum was in the library, and a very conservative middle-class background. Very happy.
What about siblings?
Older brother, Andrew, who is on my father's right. He's 3 years older than me. And then before that, I've got a 10-year-old younger brother, David, who's 10 years younger than me.
So he wasn't about for that photograph.
A mere twinkle.
Right. And you'd say you had a happy childhood, nothing you could complain about, nothing in there that you could see the roots of your trouble later?
No, a lot of people say that about whether it's hereditary. I don't believe that. I had a lovely childhood. everything that anybody could want, really. Stable, secure, loving. Didn't want for anything. It was a very privileged background. I didn't see it at the time, as you younger ones don't.
And what was school like for you?
Well, Dad was a headmaster. So, and he was a headmaster in a primary school. So primary school was great. I could use Dad for all sorts of things. The trouble was I left primary school and went to high school, or secondary modern as it was then. Dad didn't want us going to grammar school. School was fine. No, he didn't want us going to grammar school. I don't know why. I don't know. Maybe it was a tougher way through. I don't know. But I had a lovely... I loved school. I loved all the social things. I wasn't very good at school. I mean, as in academically, because it was all done on exams, and I didn't really do too well in exams, to be fair. I was a very sociable lad, and I was in all the clubs and sport and all the fun things, drama, as you will see in a bit. But yeah, I love school.
Yeah, so what did you enjoy getting up to? You're talking about drama. Was that one of your big things?
There was an amateur group that Mum and Dad were involved in, and then... Oh, dear. But then there was also one in Great Yarmouth called the Great Yarmouth Amateur and Dramatic Society. And I loved it. I loved just having fun.
What's this show that we can see on the
That's
screen?
That's Hello, Dolly. That was on the Britannia Pier, which is still there today.
A blue plaque saying Craig Hilton was here?
hardly, no. I think that was the beginning of the mask of me pretending to be other than I am.
What other productions were you in, though?
Oliver was a big one. That ran for quite a long time.
What part did you play?
I was just one of the... Well, I was the lead sort of pickpocket, if the shoe fits.
And after school, you got to find a job. So what did you do?
Well, I went to college and did business studies, and I fortunately got a job before I left college working for a building company, doing a junior accounts clerk. Back in the day, that was a very junior accounts clerk. I was making teas and photocopying. It wasn't even photocopying then. It was the roller thing, this Xerox, I think it was called. I didn't enjoy it. It was not what wasn't me. I did that because I thought that's what my parents wanted me to do. Hmm.
So what did you move on from after that?
Well, my brother was working offshore on the Oryx and earning silly money. And I asked him how was the quickest way to get offshore, and he told me, well, catering is a quick way to get off. So I did my survival course. I went off as a steward. So I was cleaning toilets and making beds and cleaning pots and pans and that sort of thing. They quickly realized that, I don't mean this derogatory, please don't have me for this, but that I had some sort of brain cells and that washing pots and pans, maybe I could do a little bit better. And I went to galley steward, then second chef, then commis chef, then what they call camp boss over a period of 3 years. And that's chef manager.
So how many staff were working under you?
There was only about 10, but then I did overtime in places where you could have 30, 40.
Mm-hmm. So this was out on an oil rig?
This is on the oil rigs, yeah.
Yes. So how many weeks did you do out there?
2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. Or if you went off Norway, you'd do 3 on and 1 off. I tried to do as much overtime as I could because I wanted to travel, and that was really the purpose behind it.
So how did your career in food and hospitality, is that what it is, or how did that develop?
I travelled around Australia, working in different restaurants and bars, and then came back, and I was fortunate enough to get a job in America on the cruise ships. It all sounds really glamorous, doesn't it? But it's really not. It's extremely hard work, long hours, and I was what they call a food manager, so I watched the food coming across the line, and then distributed it out to the waiters, and they took it to the restaurants. And so I made sure that the specs were followed. And I progressed really well in that as well. And it's a very much like the Navy. You know, you get stripes and two stripes and three stripes being the top, and I was two. But then circumstances changed.
We'll get on to that in a minute. Meanwhile, I don't know, maybe it isn't meanwhile. When did you meet your first wife and how?
So when I came back from America, I got a job as a deputy manager in a hotel in Newmarket called the White Hart Hotel. And she was the manager. Don't judge me. After a while, obviously, a relationship blossomed and I left because I couldn't work for the wife and just didn't work. And I left and I became a general manager of a local wine bar, nightclub, a very popular place called Pacino's in Newmarket, which was thriving. And we developed that into a very big business, very successful business, nightclubs. And over the next 8 to 9 years, we became the place in East Anglia, really.
And then kids came along?
We did. Sam came along, my son Sam, who's 26 now. Doesn't do that anymore. He's taller than me. And then Pippa, 3 years after that. Then we had about 8 years in Newmarket.
Happy times?
Yes, it was always, it's a hard industry, John. You work lots of hours, you work silly hours. It's the most sociable, unsociable job there is, hospitality. I would go to work at sometimes 9 o'clock in the morning if the delivery was there, and sometimes you don't finish till 4 in the morning. So I didn't really see too much of the children, but I thought that working was the be-all and end-all, that to providing for my family, and success was gleaned by what we had, a bigger house and car and holidays and stuff. And so I worked very hard. I wasn't as academic as my brothers, either of them, so my insecurities was that I had to try and progress as fast as I could and as hard as I could to catch up, so to speak.
And when did alcohol and cocaine enter your life?
Cocaine had hit me in America on the cruise ships because we worked such long hours. We were in and out of Miami every week, and it became very easy. It was like drinking a cup of coffee. And it's a really old cliche, but everybody was using cocaine to get through. And it was awful because I was the guy that, when the Drug Enforcement Agency came on board on a Sunday, I was the guy who showed them around. So I knew all the places not to go and all the places to go. So I was very deceitful. But then it just spiraled out of control. Alcohol was becoming has always been a big part, really, from when I was 18. I looked very young for my age. I know it's hard to tell now, but and so I always felt as if I had to catch up again, like I've mentioned that before. And I don't know if I always seemed to have this addictive thing that it took a grip. And obviously when I came home, I came home to Caister-on-Sea, which was a kind of little fishing village on the east coast near Great Yarmouth, and cocaine wasn't readily available, to say the least. Coca-Cola was hard to find, never mind cocaine. So alcohol took its place, and it was I was in a relationship with it from then on.
And did it really start to take over your life? I mean, did you know it was doing that? Or was it just something you thought you could control?
I had a period of abstinence, but I wasn't free of it. I was abstinence really when the children were born until probably they were 4 or 5. Yeah, probably about that age. I wasn't really in control of it. I was pretending to be dry, but I wasn't. But then it started to become a problem. I remember my brother visiting the nightclub, and I was so drunk behind the bar serving the owner came and took the keys off me and sent me home, and that was my first stint in a rehab. But I came straight out and started again. It was very hard working in an environment, and I was just deceitful. I was pretending I was okay, and it became part of me, and I was hiding it everywhere and drinking on a daily basis.
What did that do to your relationships?
Well, that ended, unfortunately. The marriage folded. I was quite shameful to say in this audience, but I lived an adultering lifestyle, working in nightclubs and bars. That's no excuse. It's me that did that. I'm not blaming my job or the environment. I chose to do that. And enough was enough. That I was not responsible to look after my children in a correct way. I'd been drink driving and all sorts of shameful things. Now you think about how much you love your children, and that's the power of addiction. Addiction takes all of that common sense and that logic and just crumples it up like a piece of paper. You just carry on doing it.
Were you able to see your children after the marriage folded?
No, I had a period of 3 years. And looking back, it's probably best that I didn't see them, because I was not in a good place to see them. But it was the hardest thing ever. It was one of the worst times of my life, in not being able to see such an important part of their life and their growth.
How old were they at the time?
10 and 7. So I didn't see them until they were 10 and 13. Hard for them too, and I'm still working at that. That's still stuff I've got to put right.
But you are back in touch with them.
Absolutely. I've had chances to speak to my son privately, and being a bit older, he's got more of an understanding. My daughter, very unfortunately, had a stroke when she was 3.
Gosh.
And so her understanding of it is still a work in progress. They were told lots of stuff by their mum, some right, some not so right. So I have to put my side across and let them discover and understand me in their way.
Do you think that your addiction to alcohol and cocaine, is it a disease or what? Stand by, folks.
Yes. That's a question, isn't it? It's always been one of those big arguments of whether it's a disease or not. It becomes a disease. I don't think it starts with that. It starts as choice of free will. I chose to drink or use to the extreme. I wish I could have socially drunk or not used drugs, but I chose to. So that was my choice. I had the capacity to understand what I was doing, so I made that choice. Once you become dependent, and that's not like anybody just socially drinking or being a heavy drinker, once you become dependent that your body needs it to function, then yes, that's when it starts to become a disease, because it's poisoned your body to the point where your body can't exist without it.
During all this time, your marriage is over, you're not seeing your kids. Did anybody stand by you?
My dad passed away at that time, which is one of the hardest things. This is where I get emotional. I will do this, I trust you, I'm terrible. Because I wish he'd have seen where I am now. But my brothers disowned me. I didn't speak to them for a lot of years. They wanted nothing to do with me. But my mum did. My mum was always there, and she's still there, and a very, very important part of my life. In desperate times, I knew that she was there. So when I was at my lowest, I always knew I had an attachment. I always knew that there was that person there that I had connection to, who my history was with, where my ancestry was, where I belonged. And when in isolation, I needed that. I'm a very sociable sort of guy. I don't do lonely. And when I do, I'm really rubbish at it. She's been my salvation.
And when you're working with other people in a similar situation that you were in, do you recognize in them the need for just somebody who's standing by them, supporting them?
Yeah, often. I mean, I work with extremely chaotic individuals who are not just alcoholics or drug addicts, but they're homeless, they've got mental health or offending or self-harm, neglect, or all of those things. And we crave normality. I mean, they just want normal. The one thing I missed when I didn't see my children was watching them sleep or eat or brushing their teeth or reading a story or just the normal mundane things. And I see it often when people come to us completely broken and lost and just not having a belonging, no purpose, no value. It's really sad. And I can obviously I empathize greatly with them. And they attach very quickly to us as staff, team, and it's hard. We've got to put the boundaries in place, and it can be kind of awkward.
Well, we'll come on more onto your work a bit later. But back to where we started. You're begging on the streets in Newcastle. So what happened next?
Begging on the streets of Newcastle, it doesn't seem even possible that you're talking to me about that. You cannot understand the shame that goes with that.
But then you're off to... How did you find Swan Lodge?
I went to the housing office in Newmarket in Newcastle. It's close. And I overheard a conversation. First of all, I was told that I was the wrong age, the wrong sex, the wrong colour, the wrong nationality to get housed. I wasn't vulnerable enough, which kind of hurt somewhat. I overheard a conversation saying, well, possibly there's some rooms at Swan Lodge in Sunderland. So I jumped the metro, and ended up... they were full when I first went there, so I slept a couple of nights in the park.
Can you explain what it is?
Swan Lodge is a 65-bed residential life house, or a hostel, as you would know it. We call it a life house because as soon as I say hostel, people just think dormitories and beds and soup kitchens, and it is far from that. It is a house of transformation and restoration, and people live there on a program. When I went there, it was a 2-year program. It's however long it takes nowadays, with support staff, 24/7 staff.
Did you have your own room, or?
Yeah, you got your own room, your own bathroom, a bit of dignity and privacy. There's usually 9 guys and girls on a landing, or 3 if they're really chaotic or sort of DV, or if they're more vulnerable. It's a canteen, so it's half board. You get your breakfast and evening meal. It's warm, it's safe, it's clean.
And what did they do for you in those initial months?
I self-detoxed, so physically they were looking after me. Detox only takes about 5 days or so. The physical aspects.
What was that like?
I've done it a few times. Not good. You hallucinate, you went to your stomach till all the bile has gone. Lovely, huh? but this is how it is, folks. You're so sick of nausea, you think your eyes are going to come out. You bleed through your eyes sometimes because you're straining so bad. All your throat is ulcerated because of the stuff that's come out. You shake violently, you sweat violently, you convulse, you black out. It's not nice.
Not fun. But you got through it.
Got through that, yeah. And then the psychological problem takes over. Then you've got to look at, you know, what, why you're drinking and what the problems are. For me, myself, it was really, I just wanted to get some volunteering under my belt, and I just stay dry for as long as I could. And at that time in Salvation Army, the Swan Lodge was to get a flat. That was success. You know, move on, get a flat, you're sorted. And that's what happened. 3 months down the road,
How did you find a flat?
Through my support worker and finally signing up for different local authorities. And it was just a 2-bedroom flat in a place called Hendon, which is quite a rough area of Sunderland. But I thought that's what I needed. That's what I thought was success again. You know, I have my own place and I would be...
You detoxed and you got your own place.
Yeah.
Hooray, you made it.
Mm. The trouble is you go from Swan Lodge, which is very social, and there's 65 other people there, and you make friends, and there's lots of activities and things to do. And then you move to a flat with four walls and nobody, apart from the telly. And so I spiraled out of control to drinking oblivion, really. Worse than I've probably ever been. And when the paramedics kicked the door down, there was 40 bottles of vodka around my feet.
How did the paramedics know to look for you?
The support worker was trying to contact me, and because they had some outreach, and the neighbour downstairs noticed mail not being picked up, and just general concern, thankfully. The paramedics forced alcohol in me through a straw for 3 hours.
Gosh, sounds bizarre, but that's what you have to do, is it?
The paramedic said, well, I've never done this before. Yeah. But because my body needed it, I just had to take sips of alcohol to get me to the point of that I could function.
Right.
Then to hospital.
Oof. And was that just a one-off?
Oh, no, that happened many times. That was the last time. The thing with addiction, lapses happen all the time. For me, it was always personal circumstances. It was always something to relational, something to do with my family or children. I had an argument with the ex-wife or something, and I would drink. If I didn't get a job interview, I'd drink. And I'd plan it, and I was very deceitful. I'd have periods of abstinence, then I'd binge. So then the binge, because you're drinking so much so quickly, you would have to detox. So, yeah, it was a common thing. But this one was so bad, I mean, I wouldn't wish that on anybody, that last one.
Did you feel at the time a sense that you'd failed? You'd got yourself dry for a bit, and then did that make it worse, that feeling?
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously I told everybody and anybody that I'd got a flat. And I was, you know, quite chuffed with myself. It was all me, me, me. Look what I've done. Haven't I great? You know, and so, yeah, the feeling of failure and shame and guilt and embarrassment, especially going back to Swan Lodge.
So they took you back?
I crawled back, literally. I kid you not, because I had a drink when I got out of hospital, which doesn't make any sense, does it? and crawled up the ramp. There's a slight ramp that leads into the front door. And, yeah, they took me back. And I stayed another 15 months.
Gosh. So how much do you value, or how important were those staff at Swan Lodge to you at that time?
We've recently lost one of the cooks who passed away a couple of weeks ago. Whilst I was there, and she sat next to me one time when I was drunk and cut up my meal and fed me like a child, because I was drunk. But she valued, she could see something. She could just see something, and that's the sort of stuff they are. You know, there's a saying at the Salvation Army, especially in homelessness, you know, see the person, not the label. And that's what they do. They just look at the person, and God bless them, I tell you. God bless them.
Well, on that sort of happy note, we're going to take our break. We're going to have a 10-minute break now. If you can make sure you're back in your seats in 10 minutes, that will be wonderful. And then we'll continue our conversation. Thanks, Craig.